Millions of Afghans have and continue to endure gross human rights violations, political and humanitarian crises since the international withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021. De facto control of the Taliban, which remains unrecognized by most of the international community, has severely restricted civic space, reintroduced and reinforced gender apartheid, while rejecting efforts to construct at least the nominally inclusive political order. In this episode, we look at how dominant narratives of state collapse and failure, shaped largely by Western expertise, have contributed to a misrepresentation of political realities in Afghanistan. What can be done to elevate the voices of Afghan civil society at home and abroad? Find out in this episode from the LSE's Conflict and Civicness Research Group. Welcome to the Conflict Zone podcast from the LSE with me, Malik Banat. Together, we explore the changing nature of global conflict in the 21st century by taking a closer look at the causes and drivers of war and intractable violence. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power producing violent conflict, and how long-term sustainable peacemaking strategies can address these seemingly chronic problems. This series of Conflict Zone is produced by PeaceRep, an international research project exploring the changing nature of conflict, peace, and transition processes in the contemporary world. PeaceRep is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth, and Development Office. The information and views set out in this podcast are those of our experts, and nothing herein constitutes the views of the FCDO. This time, I am joined by colleagues from the Afghanistan Research Network at CCRG, Marika Theros and Sahar Halamzai. In the run-up to the withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, Marika and Sahar together initiated and oversaw the Trilateral 1.5-track Dialogue on Afghanistan, a forum at the Washington-based Atlantic Council think tank designed to facilitate dialogue among American, EU, and Afghan stakeholders and encourage the representation of women while engaging other civic leaders in the conversation. For a longer time, Marika has been involved in research and dialogue processes in a number of conflict-stricken sites like the Balkans, South Asia, and the Middle East, including, of course, Afghanistan. Sahar is an active Afghan rights activist. Her research focuses on how exactly narratives and discourse shape policy practice on the ground. Marika and Sahar currently collaborate with a deep network of Afghans, some of whom have fled the conflict zone or have been exiled, and they seek to generate knowledge in response to the protracted political, economic, security, and human rights crisis facing modern-day Afghanistan.
Hi, I'm Sahar Halamzai, and I run the Afghanistan Research Network with my colleague Marika Theros. A key guiding principle behind the establishment of this network has also driven our work at the Civic Engagement Project for the last sort of 3-4 years. And that is essentially that for decades, international policies and practices in Afghanistan have been guided by Western expertise. And we saw that particularly during the Doha talks, where Afghan knowledge, experience, and expertise were either sidelined or ignored, appropriated, and often manipulated. So much of the work that we've done previously has really focused on closing that gap and bringing Afghan expertise and knowledge and experience to those decision-making spaces. And pre the collapse, one of the things that we had realized was that a lot of the decisions were obviously being made in DC, but not a lot of Afghans had access to those spaces. And we realized that what was missing at the policy level were three things. Firstly, a real appraisal of the current situation and the different political, security, and economic variables that would sort of enable and see through a peace process at that time in Afghanistan. Secondly, an actual dialogue between the US, its partners, the Afghan government, and the sort of the young generation of Afghan reformers. Something like 60% of Afghans living in Afghanistan are under the age of 30. And just as a sort of quick anecdote, we were in a private meeting with a sort of a senior EU official who had just come out of a meeting with Taliban representatives in Doha and had been told by the Taliban what had been agreed on their behalf, or on the European, on the sort of this official's behalf with the Taliban. So that's how little people were talking to one another, sort of the key actors in that space. So we decided to run a track 1.5 dialogue led by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Federica Mogherini, and the head of the then Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, which has since been dissolved by the Taliban. And ultimately, it included the sort of younger generation of Afghan officials and activists, with former officials in the US and the current and former European officials. And essentially, the idea was to not only provide an example or a demonstration of what should be done, i.e. dialogue between all of the key actors who sort of had a stake in what was happening in Afghanistan, in particular Afghans themselves, but also to have a detailed conversation on what it would take to get a peace process or really a responsible withdrawal, because by then, in our minds at least, we were very clear that this was not a peace process, this was a withdrawal. And there were many options available at the time, including sort of a lengthier, messier peace process, but that would require more time. And of course, we were working, the sort of peace process was happening against the sort of very arbitrary and very, very quick timeline. And secondly, the other thing that we did alongside these dialogues that we convened, in which we brought in all of the people who could have really been speaking to one another, is that we worked with colleagues at the South Asia Center to develop what ended up being a dedicated website for Afghan experts and activists, where they could talk about what they were seeing on the ground, about their own sort of technical knowledge, about around their own expertise and experience. And I think that was sort of the first of its kind at the time. And I want to say since, there was just nothing anywhere at the time where that was exclusively around Afghan expertise and knowledge and experience, where they could publish at a platform at that sort of level.
You mentioned the deliberations towards a peace process, or at least a responsible withdrawal. The real outcome, I'm sure we will discuss next. But all these micro-level dialogues and your activity to push them forward, this once again shows the importance of the politics of knowledge. Whose voices are we hearing and who is silenced? Marika, could you maybe elaborate on the obstacles you have faced? Because it feels like certain voices did indeed dominate the loudest in the room. I'm sure that must have been frustrating at times. And it is important to understand how we came to witness what is widely agreed to be a rushed or even botched withdrawal by the US and their allies.
So the Afghanistan Research Network is part of the Conflict and Civicness Research Group at LSE Ideas and also part of the Consortium Peace and Conflict Research and Evidence Platform. But it really comes out of the work Sahar and I have been doing the last several years as part of the Civic Engagement Project, which is also a partner in the Afghanistan Research Network. Yeah, and what was really important for us at the time, and I think what remains important today, has really been this role and the politics of expert input, especially Western expertise, and how it interacted with a US mediator who was pushing for a withdrawal or a very particular formulation of a power-sharing outcome with the Taliban. And we look at how that shaped powerful narratives and contributed sort of to the outcome of collapse. I wrote about this recently in an article for International Affairs, where I tried to sort of capture the powerful machinery that was behind the construction of these narratives, which really limited what Afghans could do, both to push back and also to engage in a peace process. And sort of these powerful narratives are now how we talk about what happened in Afghanistan. One of the main examples of this was right after, the day after the takeover, Biden said, quote, "We gave them, the Afghans, every chance to determine their own future, but what they couldn't do is actually fight." And so this idea of that the Afghan army didn't fight really doesn't consider what was actually happening at the time, was that the US was pulling out contractors in June, just 2 months before the collapse, without which those contractors, without which the army couldn't function. Some 60,000 soldiers, Afghan soldiers, had died fighting in the years up to the collapse. And until today, this narrative that the Afghan army didn't fight is used over and over again. And this really diminishes also what was happening at the time, which was targeted assassinations against civic activists, a COVID pandemic, and increasing violence. And today, we still see targeted assassinations against many of the former ANDFS soldiers. A second false idea was that Afghanistan would become some sort of Switzerland with 20 years of intervention, even though it had just experienced more than 40 years of war. This failure discourse has really taken root, and this narrative has undermined and diminished a lot of the progress that Afghans made, despite the outsized influence of U.S. security intervention. But the narrative also obscures the different factors and forces that pushed and pulled towards cooperation, fragmentation, and collapse. Institutions that were built by Afghans were not altogether rotten to the core, which was a narrative at that time. They mattered, and they actually continued to do so, no matter how imperfect. They provided much-needed services, including health, education, and economic stabilization. And even today, the Taliban is trying to sort of restart the institutions, while during the insurgency, they had grafted onto them to provide services in areas they occupied. Of course, you know, one cannot and should not compare these institutions to Switzerland or Denmark, but Afghans never did. But when you look at sort of the trajectory of other conflict-affected states and the comparison with Afghanistan, there were significant areas of progress that were worth preserving. I think, you know, this is related to another point, which is important to say, which is that Afghanistan over the last 20 years has become a site of experimentation by the international community. A number of different approaches and modalities were developed, from top down to bottom up, working with government, working with informal power breakers, and so forth. And over time, sort of the goals of the intervention evolved considerably, first continuously expanding and then contracting. Afghanistan was one of the most heavily resourced external interventions in a conflict state. And current analyses today really tends to focus mainly on domestic factors to explain the collapse. But this really overlooks sort of the interplay between local global dynamics and actors, policies and practice that helped shape a very fragmented governance and security landscape prior to the Taliban takeover. And I would argue that it was really the nature of the American security interventions, especially the war on terror and the top-down diplomatic approaches to the talks that metastasized the conflict over the last 20 years.
So in a way, if we talk about the domestic failures of the Afghan regime, we are inclined to underestimate or even overlook the role and responsibility international actors like the US has played. But was it the lack of resources allocated by Washington, perhaps a misreading of the security landscape in Afghanistan, or more fundamentally, the nature of the intervention that you mentioned? How do we go about explaining the lack of resolve we have witnessed?
Now, what's really interesting is that over the many years in doing research in Afghanistan, many of my Afghan colleagues, especially those who worked in civil society or who worked at the community level, would often describe the conflict as a form of collusion or co-production between these various forces, both domestic with the domestic elites as well as international actors that were often bound together by international resources. And so they see the rise of the Taliban, and a lot of evidence points to this, as a consequence of governance failures and as a product of continued support and sanctuary in Pakistan. Throughout the intervention, the group remained deeply unpopular with the Afghan citizenry, even as they were able to leverage discontent and survival strategies of communities in order to expand sort of their recruitment prospects and to expand their territorial gains. The other striking feature of the process and of the U.S. is that they had seemingly learned very little from previous mistakes and from the sort of history of failed peacemaking in Afghanistan. And they tended to really follow the same logic of those mistakes, but in a changing global context. Diplomatically, this meant that it followed on a succession of top-down approaches to peacemaking that had legitimized and empowered bad actors while excluding key stakeholders and the interests of most Afghan citizens. The American mediation effort itself and its dynamics also further fragmented the Afghan Republic, the elite, and civil society. Because, frankly, a new elite political settlement held out the promise of resources and positions for opposition elites, and the American mediator was able to manipulate the Afghan political marketplace. The near exclusive focus for many policy analysts at that time was on the dynamics within the Afghan Republic around the negotiations process, while also seeking to identify Taliban visions of government. But what was missing was any consideration really of the changing patterns of violence and fragmentation in the country, in which the Taliban would later exploit, and what the key variables that were required to ensure a peace process could continue as fighting increased. But even, you know, for Afghans, many of them, of course, perceived the Doha talks as an ill-designed exit strategy for the U.S. But in Western sort of discourses and analyses, it was considered a historic opportunity to forge a new elite deal that could stabilize the country. In the design of the process, the mediators attempted to create a neat binary between the Republic versus the Emirate, which really failed to reflect the nature of the conflict on the ground and address its complex drivers. But more importantly, it also suggests and implies that the Taliban and the Republic each represented 50% of the population, when that was not the case. And when, you know, as most peace processes today, you know, the concept of inclusion has, you know, really entered into sort of peace process design. But in this case, where the notion of inclusion was deployed, it really meant expanding the number of older generation of factional elites directly in the process, rather than civic actors or even sort of the interests of regional sponsors who had been playing a role in the conflict. Ultimately, this dyadic framing really affected everyone, legitimating and delegitimating Afghan voices and experiences. And as Sahar said, urban activists, women who had called for peace were just dismissed pretty quickly as part of the corrupt republic whenever their own demands and interests conflicted with the U.S. process. I think, you know, in looking and thinking through what could have been done, there was like really little appreciation that a complex 40-year generational conflict would require processes and agreements at multiple levels. Local level agreements, the role that they could play, were often dismissed amongst U.S. stakeholders and policy thinkers, which resulted in the collapse of a number of local level processes that were already underway on ceasefires. The Taliban, of course, didn't make the same mistake. In contrast, they were very adept and successful at pursuing local-level deals in order to expand territory and their recruitment prospects as they continued to stall negotiations in Doha. They had leveraged not only a sort of discontent, but also local survival strategies, especially after the signing of the U.S.-Taliban agreement signaled their return, their possible return to power. I think another major factor that needs to be considered was the change in the U.S. and global contexts. Afghanistan's international intervention never cohered, but the decision by the Trump administration to take a unilateral approach and negotiate a bilateral agreement for withdrawal and then use that as a framework for inter-Afghan peace, you know, some would say it would constitute a critical juncture. Domestically in the U.S., the framing of the forever war had taken root across the think tank landscape and the broader DC policy landscape, and created an unlikely alliance between sort of progressive anti-imperialists and sort of the isolationist right that was both well-funded and well-coordinated. Internationally, Europeans, actors at the time, including NATO, who, you know, privately often opposed the American approach but publicly fell in line with it, were really just focused on cohesion at the international level rather than on ground realities. And this was in part due to a lot of the fallout that Trump sort of created and his vocal public antagonism against NATO. Considering these factors is really important because they entrenched this reductionist framing of Afghanistan and ultimately enabled a coercive U.S. mediation approach that ultimately, you know, resulted in the collapse of the country.
If we take stock of what has happened 2 years after the collapse of the Republic, Afghan civic actors, from activists and educators to doctors and nurses, they're facing not only an uncertain future, but often harassments, arrests, and violent reprisals. Many have been forced to flee Afghanistan. They are dispersed across the world as refugees and asylum seekers, what you describe as being stuck in this sort of limbo. And it's really important to know that there was initial attention on international schemes to support and relocate civic actors and human rights defenders. But over time, this has dwindled. And so, Sahar, how would you describe the situation of Afghans today, both those who live under the Taliban regime and those who have fled?
The collapse of the Afghan Republic and the subsequent Taliban takeover has created significant trauma and uncertainty for the Afghan people, including for members of civil society, experts, activists, you know, different individuals who in some way or form sort of worked for the Republic. It has also deepened fragmentation inside and outside Afghanistan, with divisions becoming increasingly entrenched across cleavages, ethnic, gender, even professional, for example, you know, between those who once worked for the government and those who didn't. I think it's also really important to note that the vast majority of Afghans who have been evacuated and who did manage to leave after August 21 find themselves in hugely precarious situations all over the world. We have endless examples of Afghans who were activists, professionals, who are, you know, experts, teachers, who now find themselves in sort of no man's land. Afghans who are homeless, living on the streets in different cities across Europe, who are unable to pursue education, unable to pursue their work. I mean, there are countless examples in the UK, for example. There is the case of the Afghans who are being moved from hotels to hotels. You know, some of these families with small children have been living in these hotels for 2 years without any prospect of actually being resettled. So today, Afghan expertise is really scattered across the world, and support by donors, universities, and other bodies, institutions are really essential for this expertise and for this knowledge to flourish. And this can take many different forms, but requires really investment by the international community to support efforts like the Afghanistan Research Network, but also fellowships and scholarships and other opportunities for their expertise and their voices to input into academic and policy debates. You know, Afghanistan has significant on-the-ground capacity and expertise, both within the academic community, but also within civil society and technical ministries. Yet these voices and their ideas have often been sidelined, dismissed, and are rarely at the center of debates on Afghanistan. And, you know, we know what the consequences of that are now. And there's a real need for the international community to really understand and value the work of Afghan experts and researchers, many of whom have active networks on the ground, coupled with contextual understanding of the shifting dynamics at local international levels, to really inform workable policies. Afghanistan is not the Afghanistan today of 20 years ago, and the conditions over the last 2 years are different. Our understanding today of these changing conditions is limited, especially in a context where there is Taliban repression, there is a closed information environment, you know, media across the country has collapsed, there is deep fragmentation. This is especially important given the ways in which the international community will deliver aid and develop their engagement policies. And we really have to be aware of the fact that this will have downstream consequences for the future of Afghanistan.
And I guess on a more positive note here, given how tightly sealed the current information space is, as well as the difficulty of obtaining live, accurate data, you still continue to publish papers dissecting the new institutional and political context of the now Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. Marika, could you tell our listeners what these papers are about and what should we look out for in the future?
We launched the first batch of papers as part of the Afghanistan Research Network earlier this month, and the response we've received is already really positive. We've had extensive engagement in the ideas that have been presented. For example, one of our researchers makes the case for recognition of gender apartheid, arguing that Taliban decrees targeting women constitute inhuman acts, which is a violation under international law. And she makes this as comparable to apartheid South Africa. This is important because we need to recognize the decrees that limit women's freedoms are not ad hoc, but are a systematic approach to limiting women and girls' freedoms at every level. The legal and moral imperative to take a human rights lens in this instance has consequences for what these legal and political categories might mean in terms of tools available to the international community to respond. Another one of our researchers also explores the new institutional and political economy context in Afghanistan under the Taliban and shows how that needs to be taken into account when conducting macroeconomic analyses and policies in contexts where there's autocracy. He also notes how humanitarian crises and emergency food insecurity in these contexts, the desire to rely on conventional macroeconomic indicators to gauge sort of the healthiness of the economy is really misleading. Repressive practices of the Taliban, he concludes, have really reduced the stability and predictability of other institutions that matter for economic growth. But altogether, there are a total of 16 papers so far, six of which have already been published and can be found on the LSE and Peace Rep website. The papers are diverse in topics. They reflect, you know, the diversity really reflects the complexities and dilemmas that now exist in Afghanistan across humanitarian, human rights, and political dimensions. But of course, it's important to approach these issues as connected, as any response to one issue will have implications for the other. Today, so much of the research and discourse has also focused really on how best to engage the Taliban, what kind of leverage is available to help them moderate their policies and so on. Their resistance to any forms of concessions, especially after a victory against the U.S. and international community, and their need for, you know, to maintain internal cohesion amongst their fighters. Secondly, it also overlooks the majority of Afghans and their interests and needs, and also the need to engage them in the future of their own country. One of the papers speaks to this and recommends ways to use dialogues, micro-dialogues, to advance meaningful political objectives in this context.
This network is really a modest response, but we hope that we can build on it and expand it. And what we really hope to see, even beyond this network, but more broadly, is that the international community finally recognizes the value that Afghan expertise has and is willing and ready to invest in them.
For now, that concludes today's episode on the lessons and challenges in preserving Afghanistan's intellectual, human rights, and peace-building capacities. We hope you found it informative and educational, and you can find out more information on the Conflict and Civicness Research Group page of the LSE website. There you can also find details on upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all our publications. Please do follow us on Twitter at LSECCRG, and we hope to see you next time.